to turn on the recorder. Let me just say a couple things before we get back to the material. One, I'll try to do as tactfully as possible, and it may not come about tactful.
Okay.
Several people have mentioned that there's an undercurrent of talking while I'm lecturing, and they're having difficulty hearing. And so I'm just bringing that to your attention and asking you to restrain yourself. I know that what I'm saying may confuse you, but it's not intentional. So if you can just be sensitive to your classmates, that would be terrific. The other is the quiz on Monday will be on antivirals only. Now, I want to go back and refresh where we were when we stopped. We really have some interesting stuff to talk about today. We were talking about the treatment of herpes infections, and very specifically, we had the case of Bill Board, who had genital herpes, and we looked at one drug as sort of our example drug, acyclovir, for its treatment. And we saw how it worked, that it is a drug requiring activation that takes place in infected cells, the key step of which is thymidine kinase phosphorylating the drug to the monophosphate, then host kinase is activated to the tri, and then it works by two mechanisms. It competitively inhibits viral DNA polymerase, and secondly, it also gets incorporated and brings about strand termination. Now, if we talk about the pharmacology of this drug, this is an orally active drug that can also, in severe situations, be used intravenously. Its major, almost exclusive use is oral, and it has fairly poor bioavailability. About 20% of the drug is absorbed. That which is absorbed is distributed, including into the central nervous system. And it is metabolized and excreted by the kidneys. So it gets into the central nervous system, which is a significant feature. It is used, or let me say something about side effects, and then I want to go back and talk about its cousins. There are a whole variety now, three other drugs that have come out. Here's the key point. Bioavailability of acyclovir is 20%. The side effects that you see with this drug, okay, involve headache and nausea. Some patients will have diarrhea and vomiting. All of these are relatively rare side effects. This is a well-tolerated drug. There are three acyclovir-like drugs that are used to treat herpes infections. In fact, herpes simplex, herpes varicella zoster, or shingles, forget cytomegalovirus, there's a much more potent drug. But I'll come back to both of these in a second. Let me just introduce you to the cousins so you get the whole family. This is clearly the prototype drug. There are three other drugs that are now available, and let me describe them to you. One is valacyclovir. And what valacyclovir is the valine ester of acyclovir. It is nothing more than a prodrug. The valine ester of acyclovir gets absorbed, cleaved to acyclovir. And it has improved bioavailability. And I don't know where this smudge came from. I am sorry. This is a recent phenomenon. I just drew this on here. And it achieves levels in the blood that are 3 to 5 times higher than acyclovir. So it is simply a formulation of acyclovir that provides greater bioavailability, higher blood levels. Yes?
So does this get into the CNS?
Yes. Also? Yep. Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. It's acyclovir. More gets in because the blood levels are higher. Then there's a drug that is called Pencyclovir, and all of these basically work by the same mechanism, that is used topically because it is not absorbed systemically. It is used topically to treat herpes simplex and varicella from a topical perspective, but specifically herpes simplex and herpes simplex 2. Then there's one more formulation, and that is there's a prodrug formulation of pencyclovir, and I realize this becomes really complicated. We'll jump back to acyclovir. This is a prodrug of pencyclovir that is not absorbed, a prodrug form that is absorbed to about 85%. All of these prodrug formulations are taken orally. Obviously, one gets higher blood levels, which means greater efficacy in the treatment of simplex and zoster. Now, go ahead, Tim. Yep. Pencyclovir alone is topical. If you can get the puppy into the patient, it can be used effectively, systemically. Given to the patient, incorporated, converted to pencyclovir.
So pencyclovir, different from the other, is not taken.
Got it. Only topical. Only here for herpes simplex 1. So there are basically 3 drugs, Bing, Bing, and Bing, that can be used as potential therapeutic agents for billboard. I want to go back to billboard. Billboard's got genital herpes, and physicians use any one of these 3 to treat. So Bill has the acute attack. If you remember the case, he's sitting at the health center. The doctor prescribes acyclovir. And if he takes acyclovir, this is the first view of the immune system to the virus. So it's still in the catch-up mode, mounting a response. If he takes acyclovir, he will shorten the duration of the initial acute attack, and he will diminish or have diminished intensity of that attack. It is not a profound effect. This is not penicillin treating strep throat. There is a shortening that's modest. There's a decrease in severity of infection that's modest. Now, he then, because this is a lifetime gift that hangs out in the nerves in latent form, he would be a candidate for suppressive therapy, preventative therapy, if you like, and placed on acyclovir or one of these drugs to suppress the sloughing of the virus, which occurs to some degree in all patients, some more than others and some at certain times more than others, to prevent the recurrence. And if one places Bill on acyclovir, and he is compliant, one can reduce the number of outbreaks and the severity of those outbreaks significantly. All these other drugs provide are different formulations of basically the same principle for acyclovir. So we've dealt with herpes simplex, and particularly herpes simplex 2, but in actuality, herpes simplex 1 can cause genital herpes as well. Herpes simplex, genital herpes. What about shingles? What about varicella zoster? One can, if an outbreak of shingles is detected early, place a patient on any one of these formulations, okay? Obviously, those that have better bioavailability and higher blood levels are more frequently used. And if you do that, you again can decrease the duration of the outbreak and decrease the symptoms. What the drugs appear to have less effect in influencing is the neuropathy associated with it, the nerve injury that occurs with the shingles that persists long after the lesions have healed. So healing of lesions and the severity of the lesions will be influenced by treatment with any one of these compounds in a decreasing, shortening manner. Do we have it? Acyclovir and its relatives. This, I believe, now is generic. These are designer drugs that are very expensive. But all function by primarily the same fundamental mechanism. Now, you notice here that these drugs also have some activity against cytomegalovirus. The reality is there is a more potent compound that's 20 to 30 times more potent that is really the premier drug, the primary drug for treating cytomegalovirus. And this is a compound called ganciclovir. Its use is restricted to the treatment of cytomegalovirus. Its mechanism involves, it's basically the same as acyclovir. It involves activation to the triphosphate that then functions, one, as an inhibitor of cytomegalovirus DNA polymerase, and the activated drug 2 gets incorporated and leads to chain termination. Now, this drug can be activated by host cell kinases. Thus, the activation does not take place just in cells that are infected with the cytomegalovirus. And its selectivity as a result is dramatically less than that of acyclovir. It is given either orally or intravenously. And its use is to treat cytomegalovirus in AIDS patients or transplant patients, patients that are immunosuppressed or immunoincompetent, where this opportunistic herpes-related virus causes infection. The side effects associated with ganciclovir are severe, dose-dependent neutropenia. It is reversible, but it frequently results in dose-limiting toxicity that forces one to either back off the dose or terminate the use of the drug. This is a toxic compound. It is the drug for dealing with cytomegalovirus in immunosuppressed patients. We're all infected with it, or all. Most of us have this virus camped out in our bodies. It is the ability of the immune system to suppress it that prevents us from having outbreaks of cytomegalovirus. And it's not just retinopathy, it can involve the pulmonary system, etc. Just like we saw with acyclovir, there is now a prodrug form of ganciclovir. Surprisingly, it is the valine ester or valyl ester of ganciclovir. And this compound is highly orally active, gets taken up, the valine gets cleaved, producing concentrations of ganciclovir in the blood that are similar to those that one gets with IV administration. So it is a highly efficient way to administer the drug and achieve high blood levels of the drug without having to do it systemically or parenterally. Yes? Ganciclovir, really, if you want to talk about a prodrug being a drug that requires activation. No, ganciclovir is not a prodrug. And in fact, it typically, in severe cases of cytomegalovirus, is given intravenously. Here now is an oral way to administer the drug. But it must be, if you're thinking of a prodrug, a drug that is requires metabolic activation. I don't think that fits the definition. Yes? I believe that it does. Because cytomegalovirus in the central nervous system is a significant problem. Yeah, Tim. If you got that, you got it. Acyclovir works two ways. Gets activated, competitively inhibits, and becomes incorporated and jams up DNA synthesis. Yes. I don't know. It would be a tough decision to have to make to treat a pregnant woman with this drug. My guess is it's probably so toxic it would function as an abortifacient, causing an abortion. Yeah.
About the mechanism of action again, I might have missed the same thing Tim did. Did you say that it's the host's kinase instead of the virus's kinase in this case that activates it?
Both can. But I'm saying host cells can activate it too. Therefore, there's no selective toxicity. Yeah, absolutely. Okay? We got herpes down. Herpes is a big deal. Let me tell you, doctors of tomorrow in Nawbonne, you're going to see a lot of herpes. Okay? And the fact of the matter is there are drugs that can effectively manage it, never cure it, but manage the disease. If you manage the disease, they also decrease the ability of the patient to transmit the disease. Okay? Now we're going to go to a most interesting subject one that's very complicated. And that is, we're going to turn our attention to the treatment of HIV. Now, let me just say, as sort of invocation, the treatment of HIV is as complicated as the treatment of neoplastic diseases. It's not for the GP. It's not for the routine physician. It is for somebody that specializes in treating HIV patients, an infectious disease person, etc. But you need to know what these drugs are and how they work. And I could just as well use that as the invocation to cancer drugs. You're not going to be using them, but you very well are going to have patients that are taking these drugs, and you need to know what they do to your patient. So, HIV. Let me just give you a couple details. You've heard many of these, but this is quite a profound disease. The data suggests that 600 people an hour become infected with HIV. So while I'm pontificating up here, probably 500 will become infected. About 15,000 a day on average.
Is that worldwide?
That's worldwide. About 5.5 million a year. Somewhere between 45 and 50 million are infected. The vast majority of these, as you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, because that's what we know. We don't know yet a lot about Asia. We know very little about China, and India is still a case to be determined. But the rates in India that have been defined have been much lower than projected. In the United States, there are about 45,000 new cases of HIV each year. So if you think of the consequences of this disease, both in the life of the infected individual and then the people affected by that person having a parent, children becoming orphaned, etc. The impact of this disease is enormous. And in sub-Saharan Africa, what you're seeing is there's a shortage of school teachers because they're dying off. There's a shortage of nurses. There's a shortage of everything, workers, because of this disease. I don't want to preach. So, in order to understand the drugs that are used to treat, you have to understand the life cycle of the virus. And so I'm going to review it with you. If this is old hat, just bear with me, because otherwise we can't talk all using the same language. Here's the HIV virus, and we know a ton about this virus, probably more than all of the other viruses combined, yet have not been able to effectively or totally eliminate it. This is the virus. It's an RNA virus. It's a retrovirus. And we'll see why in just a second. And here's the RNA, and it comes equipped with a couple key enzymes. It comes equipped with a reverse transcriptase enzyme. It comes equipped with an integrase enzyme. And it comes equipped, or in the genome is encoded, a protease enzyme. In order for this virus to get into a cell, it has to associate with a receptor and a co-receptor. The receptor that it prefers to attach to through these glycoproteins is a CD4 receptor. So cells that have CD4 receptors become candidates for infection. The predominant, but not the exclusive, is the helper T cell. It also requires a functional co-receptor. So one receptor is not sufficient. A functional co-receptor is also required in order for the virus to attach. And mutations in this co-receptor make individuals less susceptible to infection with HIV. We can go there later, but not now. So the virus attaches. Here's the plasma membrane. For our example, we'll say this is a helper T cell, and it enters the cell. There are various processes by which this happens, releasing the genome, and the genome gets copied by viral encoded reverse transcriptase into double-stranded DNA. The double-stranded, and this is where retro back-ass words, if you like, the term comes. RNA to DNA, and then DNA to message to protein. So here's the retro piece of the terminology. Once the double-stranded DNA has been synthesized, it is transported to the nucleus and integrated into your genetic material for life. As a provirus. The provirus then can be activated, leading to synthesis of message, leading to copying of the viral RNA genomic material. The message gets translated on ribosomes to proteins. The proteins get snipped up into individual specific proteins, and this process takes place or is mediated by an enzyme called protease that is also viral encoded, and the resultant polypeptides are assembled and the virus is released from the infected cell to once again enter cells that have the prerequisite CD4 receptor and co-receptor. There are two major targets, and in fact, there are several targets that have been used. There is one drug that is insanely expensive that targets the ability of the attached virus to enter the host cell. It is rarely used, only in highly resistant individuals that are highly resistant and also highly wealthy. So we're going to look at the two targets that are the primary targets for the treatment of HIV that are unique targets in the replication cycle. One is going to be reverse transcriptase. There's two classes of drugs that work there, and the other is out here in right field with the protease. So the first place we're going to look is the enzyme that reverse transcribes the RNA of the genome to the DNA, reverse transcriptase. Now let me say that all of the drugs, or let me put it a different way, none of the drugs that are currently available to treat HIV-infected patients eradicate the infection. You don't cure this disease. You suppress viral replication, you decrease the viral load, and you allow, which then allows the immune system to recover some of its functionality. So as one decreases the viral load, the immune system improves and the patient has fewer opportunistic infections and a prolongation of life. The drugs that are used to treat the reverse transcriptase inhibitors fall into two groups. And one of these groups is a group called nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, frequently abbreviated as such. Here's what I would like to do. I'd like to describe this group of drugs in its entirety, not nitpick down to individual drugs. I think that's beyond what we need to be worrying about. And then I'll go back and just point out about one of the drugs that you're familiar with. All of these drugs, and so you can simply put in here information related to the class. All of these drugs operate by the same mechanism of action. They are all anti-metabolites of either pyrimidine bases or purine bases. They are lookalikes. If you like, They're fraudulent copies of the real thing. They're knockoffs. They are all totally synthetic. And if you look, we'll just use one example here, one you're familiar with, AZT. Here's the naturally occurring thymidine nucleoside, and here's the drug AZT. The difference is this hydroxyl is replaced by an azo group, and this hydroxyl is removed. But this would be the hydroxyl to provide the deoxyribose. So the fraudulent, fakey part is this azo group. Size, structure, it looks like the real McCoy. These drugs work, and AZT specifically becomes activated to the triphosphate. Host kinases activate the drug. It then becomes incorporated into the DNA strand that's being synthesized by reverse transcriptase and brings about chain termination. The clinical use of this drug, or this class of drugs, all of these drugs are orally active. All of these drugs cross the blood-brain barrier, and that's an important feature because HIV, central HIV, is an important site of infection. The drugs are primarily eliminated by renal excretion after varying degrees of metabolism. So any kind of renal impairment, any kind of renal dysfunction necessitates dose modification, dose reduction. Resistance occurs to the use of these drugs. They are never used alone, always used in combination. And resistance is a process of multiple mutations in the gene that encodes reverse transcriptase. So this is stepwise resistance. One mutation, two mutations, three mutations, four or five mutations of the reverse transcriptase gene lead to high levels of resistance. The resistance plays out by two ways. One, decreased ability of reverse transcriptase to incorporate the activated drug. And there is also some evidence that cells learn to repair, to excise, to remove the fraudulent nucleotide before it can bring about a cytotoxic effect. As you know, reverse transcriptase is a sloppy enzyme. Mutates, there's a mutation every time it carries out the reverse transcription of RNA to DNA. That leads to mutations in a variety of things. Reverse transcriptase, surface molecules that are antigens are constantly changing. In addition, these mutations, as a result of reverse transcriptase changes, also mean that HIV is not homogeneous. It is a very heterogeneous swarm of the HIV virus. We're going to see that becomes important because there's different drug sensitivities then. There's different degrees of susceptibility. The side effects that one sees, some are unique to the specific compound. There are some that the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors have in common. All are capable of causing a potentially fatal syndrome of lactic acidosis. This may or may not be accompanied also by fatty degeneration of the liver. So all can produce lactic acidosis, and all to varying degrees can suppress bone marrow. And you're going to hear this many, many times when we talk about cancer drugs. Both the lactic acidosis, the bone marrow, and many of the side effects observed with the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors are believed to result from inhibition of host mitochondrial DNA polymerase. If we simply look at AZT, everything we said generally holds for AZT, its mechanism, its clinical use. And you can see here some of the side effects. Bone marrow suppression leads to anemia, sometimes requiring transfusion. There are a variety of effects, hepatitis, neutropenia, etc., etc. Now, the context to put this in is this is one, this class of drugs, is one class of drugs that's used in multi-drug regimens for the treatment of HIV patients. So already now you have, I'll just use AZT as an example, a drug that comes with considerable baggage because we're talking about long-term chronic use. And cumulative overlapping side effects have caused loss of compliance among many HIV patients. So one of the classes of drugs that inhibits reverse transcriptase is the nucleoside. There is a second group, the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And there are several of these typified by the compound nevirapine. Yes? They don't. There are various protocols. Why don't they use these other ones? No, no. It is one of a number that are used. And we will see when we get to how to treat this, how to manage this. There are protocols that involve using two of these drugs along with a protease inhibitor or two of these drugs along with another non-nucleoside. And basically, one is balancing out efficacy of kill and trying to minimize toxicity to the patient. The non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, as you can see, are going to be lipid-soluble molecules. We'll use nevirapine, I think, as a good example thereof. Here are the features that characterize this class of compounds. They do not require metabolic activation. The drug that's consumed is the drug that's effective. They are not incorporated into viral DNA. Rather, they directly inhibit reverse transcriptase. They do it non-competitively. They do it by binding to a non-essential site distant from the active site of reverse transcriptase. So these non-nucleoside compounds bind to a non-essential adjacent site to the active site and most likely bring about a structural conformation of reverse transcriptase that makes it non-functional. They are orally active. They enter the central nervous system. The most common side effects that you see among this class of drugs is rash. We'll come back to this in a second. Rashes, and the ability to induce cytochrome P450 enzymes. The advantages that one sees with the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors is they lack effects on bone marrow. And they lack cross-resistance with the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. So HIV that is resistant to the nucleoside will still be sensitive to the non-nucleoside. This class of drugs, just again for example sake, is typified by nevirapine. Now, when I go back to rash, because rash is common among all of these, rash can lead to severe loss or exfoliation of the skin called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And it can be fatal. And so most protocols using non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors involve 2 weeks at half dose with the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors to make certain that the patient is not going to have a severe life-threatening rash. Nevirapine also, in addition to crossing the blood-brain barrier, crosses the placenta, gets into mother's milk, and has been a drug, not the only drug and not the only way to do it, used to decrease vertical transmission, mother to child. And there are various ways that this can be done. We'll talk about it when we talk about the drug regimens. The reality is it's probably the most successful, if you like, prevention mechanism, short of behavior change, that's available. One can, I'm just ballparking, but I'm very, very close. If mama is HIV positive, becomes pregnant, the chances are about 25-30% that the child will be HIV infected. Not HIV positive, because the kid's going to get mama's antibodies, okay? HIV infected. One can start antiretroviral drug therapy, and there are various, again, it's a very complicated area, late in the pregnancy, and one can dramatically reduce that 25-30% down to single digits, depending on where you are and the availability of the drugs that you have to treat. Okay, one other class, and then I'm going to take 5 more minutes, and you can have 5 more minutes at the end. Let's get through antiretrovirals, and then we'll use the bathroom and do whatever you need to do. Yeah. Ah, yeah. You wanted me to go back to the kid? Yeah. Antibodies to HIV or conversion takes in an individual that's infected. It will. You can detect infection probably by measuring viral RNA at about 2.5 weeks. Antibodies by 21 to 28 days, 3 to 4 weeks, okay? Baby is going to have antibodies from mama. So if you check baby, baby's going to be HIV positive. And baby at 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, four is likely to be HIV positive. Baby, okay, so that's frequently referred to as HIV exposed, okay? Exposed, but you don't really know if he or she is infected. Then at about 6 months, 8 months, one can test, and if that is still positive, that child's infected. And that's a huge problem, and I could soapbox on it, but I won't. It's just it's an enormous problem. Yeah.
So the mother passes her antibodies to the child?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Your mom passed them to you. That's why when you were born, you didn't get a lot of infections early in your life. And as mama, okay, maternal antibodies decreased in you, you went to the nursery and Judas, you were sick all the time.
It just seems like a really specific antibody for something, right?
No. Antibodies, okay. Get across the placenta. Okay? I mentioned rashes. The other major problem, and they vary to the extent that they do it, is the ability to induce cytochrome 450 enzymes, and specifically 3A4. 3A4 involved in oxidations, and so you have, what I'm saying is you have the potential for multiple drug interactions. So the non-nucleotide inhibitors can induce the liver and influence the metabolism of a variety of drugs, okay? Let me just give you a couple. Oral contraceptives, warfarin, ketoconazole, as examples, okay? And protease inhibitors. They're used with protease inhibitors. And so because of the liver induction, the dose of the protease inhibitor must be elevated. Okay, one last class, and then I'll wrap it for you, and I probably won't finish, but we'll take a break. In the 1990s, it was very clear that we were lacking drugs that were targeting other targets as well as were less toxic than we were seeing with the reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And so a search was undertaken to see if a second target could be identified. And the second target is the viral encoded enzyme called protease, and it is an aspartyl protease. Here is simply an example of the structure of one of these compounds. They are peptidyl compounds. So they basically, as we will see, are going to be competitive inhibitors of this enzyme. And what does this enzyme do? Well, it takes and plays a critical step late in viral replication. And that is, it takes the hot dogs, the bratwurst, that are being synthesized and snips them, cleaves them into the individual proteins. So its role is to take the protein that comes off here as a polyprotein and cleave it, bing, 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 into individual constituent proteins that then are incorporated when the virus assembles. When this enzyme is inhibited by these drugs, this process does not take place, and the virus assembles dysfunctional, non-functional virions or produces. This class of drugs is highly specific for the HIV aspartyl protease. The doses required to inhibit protease enzymes in the host are much, much higher. All of these compounds are orally active. All are able to get into the brain. All are metabolized by the liver. And the metabolites eliminated in the urine. They are never used alone, as every class of drugs that we've talked about, always in combination. And they come with some side effects. So let me just talk about the side effects that are unique to this class of compounds. Oh, I might also tell you one other piece of information, and you'll see this played out. They appear to be synergistic when used in combination with the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. There are
just the nucleoside.
There are side effects that are unique to individual compounds. There are common side effects, and that's what I want to talk about. What are the common side effects that you see within this class? Okay? One common side effect is the ability to inhibit cytochrome P450 oxidations. Okay? So first you have reverse transcriptase inhibitors that are inducers. You can see how messy this gets. And then you have now a group of drugs that are inhibitors. And the patient is not just taking these drugs. The patient is taking medicines for pain. The patient is dealing with opportunistic infections, and this becomes incredibly complicated fast. So inhibition of cytochrome P450 oxidations, okay, will lead now to elevated levels of certain drugs that are metabolized along those pathways. Secondly, it has the ability to cause what is referred to as a lipodystrophy, a redistribution of fat. And in patients that take these drugs for any period of time, there will be a redistribution of fat from the extremities and the legs to the abdomen and the upper back. And in fact, they will develop to some degree, depending again on how long in the patient, almost a humpback, almost a cushionoid type appearance. To the extent that they refuse to take the drug because it signals the people in the population that they are taking that drug and they're HIV infected. Nevertheless, you'll see that these are incredibly useful drugs. They also have the ability, this is infrequent, but it happens, to produce hyperglycemia. So they can exacerbate diabetes, and they can precipitate diabetes in a non-diabetic. And then finally, they have, and the complications or the ramifications here are not totally clear, they have the ability to elevate triglycerides and cholesterol. This is a trade-off. What's the long-term consequences of that in terms of cardiovascular function, et cetera, is yet to be determined. The odds are that there is significant effect, but one has to manage the virus. I'm going to stop here. You need a break, and so do I. When we come back, we will look at, now that you know the three classes, how are these drugs used, and what's been the effect of their use on the treatment and the mortality rate in terms of HIV. And so take a break, and we'll pick up the story.